Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, September 21st, 2020. Some South Sudanese speak out on the International Peace Day.
A widow stays redundantly jobless. Even the one with a husband, the husband may be jobless. Before the conflict in 2013, each person had a job to do at their own home, grow crops, implement family plans.
And activists in Juba say the implementation of the country's peace agreement is stuck.
Most of the conditions have remained largely the same throughout. And in that regard, the issue of insecurity and the issue of economic hardships in the country. And this is even worsening in a way.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some internally displaced persons residing at the UN Protection of Civilian Sites say the Transitional Government of National Unity should provide services, including healthcare, jobs, and unite communities torn apart by conflict in order for peace to be a reality. The IDPs say they have been living in UN-run camps under harsh conditions over the past 7 years. For VOA News, Onen Walters Solomon reports from Juba.
55-year-old Teresa Joan Scholl lives with her four children in a UN-run POC site in the Jonglei state capital, Bor, after her husband was killed in an attack on the camp in 2014. Scholl says IDPs, like her, have no security and no hospital to attend.
If we go in the bush outside the camp, we cannot collect firewood. We cannot get charcoal. At this age, I cannot go to collect firewood in the bush. My children are still young. Others are in school, in Bentiu and outside this country. I have no means to help them. We are facing problems in this country as if it is not our own.
Scholl says life is particularly tough for widows like herself.
A widow stays redundantly jobless. Even the one with a husband, the husband may be jobless. Before the conflict in 2013, each person had a job to do at their own home. Grow crops, implement family plans, sell things and generate money for children to buy basic needs such as shoes, study well. But we have really suffered during these 7 years.
Like other families in the POC, Scholl says she and her children have little to eat and rely on food such as lentils provided by the UN World Food Programme. Scholl says she routinely goes into the bush to search for wild vegetables.
Every day when I wake up, I go into the bush to fetch firewood, searching for edible vegetables such as green veggies and okra, leafy green vegetables. I bring and cook with firewood that I collect and feed my children.
IDP camp chairman Makwashi Nunkem is a 43-year-old father of seven children who has also lived in the Bor POC since 2013. Kem teaches agriculture and commerce at a secondary school in Bor. He says before the government closed down schools to prevent the spread of COVID-19, he earned a salary from an aid agency.
I bought clothes before the crisis. Then I have been inside here. I cannot buy anything. I have been teaching in a secondary school. I got 7,000 South Sudanese pound from the agency. We use it for home consumption. There is no work now. Nothing now. It is only the UN food that we depend on it.
John Holliger, a human rights security advisor at the Swiss Embassy in Juba, says her government and other donors believe the unity government should use this period of peace to create opportunities for citizens.
We've been happy to see some progress on the implementation of the peace agreement. However, we are really looking forward to see the Transitional National Legislative Assembly as well as the Council of States reconstituted. These are really important if the government is going to work as one and for the government to be efficient to deliver services to the people of South Sudan.
Olika says she's officials still worry about some of the events happening on the ground, such as deadly intercommunal violence in parts of the country. Holiga is urging the government to improve health care, do more to empower women in the country, and to provide educational opportunities for youth. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
Some members of the South Sudan civil society groups in Juba say the implementation of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement have slowed down. The executive director of the local NGO Organization for Responsive Governance says some South Sudanese continue to suffer on a daily basis 2 years after the peace deal was signed. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Rajab Mohandis, executive director for local NGO Organization for Responsive Governance, says citizens continue to suffer on daily basis 2 years after partners in the unity government signed the peace deal. According to the United Nations' latest humanitarian report, 7.5 million people across the country are in need of aid. Mohandis says people generally believe the agreement has not changed their situation.
Most of the conditions have remained largely the same throughout, and in that regard, the issue of insecurity and the issue of economic hardships in the country, and this is even worsening in a way as it stands now.
Over the past 2 years, Mohandis says South Sudanese leaders have done little to establish a system of governance that respects the rule of law, human rights, diversity, and human dignity. He says the parties are focused more on how much they as individuals can benefit from the deal rather than serving citizens. Mohandis says South Sudanese should tell the parties to employ the same vigor with which they fought each other to implement the peace deal.
The people who bear these challenges need to speak out to these parties that we cannot continue like this as a country. And that is very important. And that includes all of us, civil society, religious leaders, the intellectuals of this country, community leaders should actually speak out to these parties that this situation must stop. We can't continue like this as a country.
Mohandis says the slow pace of implementing the agreement indicates the party leaders are trying to block implementation of key reforms in order to buy time.
Full implementation of this agreement would mean a lot of reforms, and many seem to fear these reforms because these reforms might tamper with their political powers and control over resources of this country.
Chapter 4 of the peace deal mandates a complete review of key financial institutions in the country, including the Central Bank, the Ministry of Finance, the Anti-Corruption Commission, and a National Audit Chamber. It also calls for the establishment of new national institutions such as a public procurement and asset disposal authority, a health care support fund, and a support fund for students. Chapter 5 of the agreement also calls for the formation of a hybrid court by the African Union Commission, which has yet to be established. The court is supposed to investigate and prosecute individuals bearing responsibility for human rights violations committed from December 15, 2013 through the end of the transitional period. Activist Akwoch Ajang, head of the South Sudan Civil Society Alliance, which took part in the IGAD-led peace talks, says the parties are dragging their feet.
Without us coming out and actually make a pressure to the parties to the agreement, this agreement will not be implemented.
Ajang says a continuous lack of political will and mistrust among the parties remains a big obstacle to carrying out the agreement. Ajang says citizens should disown leaders who are spoilers of the peace process.
Any sanction from international community, from the region, may not even work, actually. And this is the reality. The only way is that the people of South Sudan themselves, we are the one to sanction those leaders who are not willing to work with the people of South Sudan by avoiding them.
The parties have so far implemented parts of Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 of the agreement, which call for the formation of a transitional government, the appointment of governors for the agreed to number of states, and a joint integration of all different armed forces into a national force. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Herbalists in the South Sudan capital Juba say it's not easy to treat their clients who have coronavirus. The herbalists say they have treated diseases with similar symptoms like COVID-19 in the past. The traditional healers say they are not able to go to the forest and bushes to search for medicinal plants due to insecurity. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Since the outbreak of COVID-19, herbalists in some African countries have joined health experts worldwide in the search for a possible cure for the deadly pandemic. South Sudanese herbalist Thomas Juma, who sells herbs at Juba's Custom Market, says he has been thinking about how herbalists might try to treat the novel coronavirus. Juma says he has sold local herbs to treat the common cold, syphilis, diarrhea, malaria, and other illnesses for the past 10 years.
We have heard about the COVID-19, but what we know in the past is when someone has common cold, heavy cough, he or she is given guava leaves, dikertimele, tioga boiled with water, and he or she takes it for a period of 2 to 3 days.
He says he and other herbalists normally collect the herbs from the roots of medicinal plants that grows in nearby bushes or forest. But South Sudanese herbalist says they cannot find herbs that cures the coronavirus, in part because they lack the technology and medical equipment to examine herbs to determine whether they can treat the virus or not.
It is only by God's wisdom that we are able to identify the medicinal plants among other plants. The challenge now is that people cannot go 20 meters outside Juba to go and look for the right medicinal plants that can cure COVID-19.
Yusuf Abdallah, another herbalist at Juba's Custom Market, says there is a possibility that the herbs which can treat respiratory infection could treat COVID-19. Abdallah says he treats many clients with symptoms of common cold, cough, and other minor diseases.
Any herb that treats respiratory infection, when mixed with other herbs that we are yet to identify, could possibly treat coronavirus. For example, asthma disease, it can cause difficulty in breathing. That means any herbs that treat asthma may cure coronavirus. I wanted you to know that if the Western doctors use herbs to treat patients, the only difference is that their herbs are mixed with chemicals.
40-year-old Alex Tony, who lives in Juba Nyokuron residential area, says he has not bought drugs from a pharmacy for several years. Tony says every time he feels ill, he first goes to the clinic to get tested for malaria. If the test comes back positive, he takes a local herb locally known as dikertimele, which is in the group of aloe vera plants.
I usually take dikertimele, aloe vera, or herbs to treat myself against stomach ache, malaria, and other illnesses. I believe much in our local herbs. That is why whenever I fall sick, then I immediately take the herbs. Sometimes I just go to the hospital for laboratory testing, but later take herbs for the disease. I think COVID-19 has been there before now, only that people don't realize it.
Tony says he believes that if given a chance, South Sudanese herbalists could find a cure or a vaccine to prevent COVID-19. Juma is appealing to the Juba City Council to designate a separate area where herbalists can open shops to sell their organic medicine.
The challenge we have been faced here is that there are no places or shops where we can put our herbal medicines. We only display the herbs on a table, exposing it to dust, even though it was washed at home before we bring it to the market. Juba City Council has failed to take our business into consideration.
Several based herbalists have said that they do not feel safe heading into the country's forests and bushes to search for medicinal plants because of insecurity in the parts of the country. Last week, the World Health Organization endorsed a protocol for testing African herbal medicines as potential treatment for the coronavirus and other pandemics. In a statement on Saturday, WHO says the 25 members of the Regional Expert Advisory Committee on the Traditional Medicine for COVID-19 are tasked with supporting countries to enhance research and development of traditional medicine-based therapies against the virus. They will guide implementation of the approved protocols to generate scientific evidence on the quality, safety, and efficiency of herbal medicine for COVID-19, according to WHO. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias, reports from Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, how is the COVID-19 economic-related impact affecting internally displaced persons? That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could relive an age, what age would you like to be?
I would like to go back to my secondary school days because there are other things that I see that I did not do well. I was very childish.
I would say that the age between 20 and 22nd. By that time, I think I was very more handsome than today, and I was energetic than today.
That's 18, because it's the time I enjoyed most. I got to know more about life, what the world is all about.
I would like to be at the age of 17, because at that time, we go out. We go out for hunting, playing football, or a lot of entertaining activities.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. New research by the Norwegian Refugee Council shows the devastating economic impact of COVID-19 on displaced people is worse than thought and is pushing away many into hunger, homelessness, and education crisis. The report warns richer countries ignore the plight of the poor countries at their own risk. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
These countries have been plagued with war, violence, climate change, natural and other disasters for years. Now they are faced with the COVID-19 pandemic, which is creating multiple new problems linked to lockdowns and other restrictions aimed at curbing the virus. The Norwegian Refugee Council reports 77% of people surveyed have lost their jobs or incomes since March. 70% have cut out one or more meals a day and are going hungry. And 73% say they are unlikely to send their children back to school because of economic hardship. NRC Secretary General Jan Egeland warns the world's most vulnerable communities are in a dangerous downward spiral. He says the economic impact of the pandemic is pushing them to catastrophe.
It is now a question of survival for hundreds of millions. And the North, the big economies, is not even close to understanding the crisis in the South, in the countries where we work.
Egeland says the richer countries are contributing less money at a time when developing countries are most in need of their support. As of now, he notes only 25% of the UN's 2020 humanitarian appeals have been funded. He says cries of poverty by industrialized countries are not credible. To press this point, he refers to a UN report which says the Organization for Economic Cooperation and G20 countries have produced stimulus packages amounting to $11 trillion, approximately 10% of global gross domestic product. He says there is money.
It's just not going to the Sahel where the biggest problem is, to the most conflict-prone countries, to the most disaster-prone countries. This will, of course, lead to instability in some parts of the world that will come back to haunt the robust world.
Egelin says it is in the self-interest of the large economies to help the impoverished world weather this pandemic. He warns this crisis will spiral out of control without urgent action. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Ethiopia, where opposition leader and 22 others are appearing in court Monday after being charged Saturday with terrorism and other crimes. Mohamed, a media tycoon and an outspoken critic of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, was arrested in July following the killing of popular singer Hachalu Hundessa, a champion of the Oromo ethnic group. Political analysts say the charges are likely to raise tension in the Oromia, Ethiopia's largest and most populous region. Simon Marks reports for VOA from Addis Ababa.
In November last year, Jawar, who runs a television channel, the Oromia Media Network, met with Prime Minister Abiy in hopes of convincing him to revise his nationalist agenda and favour more political autonomy for Ethiopia's diverse collection of regions, including Oromia. But the two men's relationship fell apart and Jawar joined the opposition Oromo Federalist Congress. He began campaigning against the government inside packed sports stadiums. Then in late June, after the death of Hachalu Hundessa, Jawar and some of his loyalists joined the body en route to the singer's hometown, Ambo. Someone, it is unclear who, decided to hold a ceremony for the body in Addis Ababa. When a standoff between federal security officials and Jawar's supporters ensued, a police officer was shot dead and Jawar later arrested. Authorities have now charged Jawar with inciting ethnic violence through his television channel and speeches. He's also charged with telecommunications fraud and terrorism. The charges could prevent Jawar from running in Ethiopia's upcoming but still unscheduled elections. William Davison, a senior analyst for International Crisis Group, says Jawar's potential absence could undermine the polls.
Unless prosecutors provide convincing evidence during this upcoming trial that these Oromo opposition leaders are guilty of these grave charges, then if they are convicted, there will undoubtedly be a widespread public perception, especially in Oromia, that the Ethiopian government is once again engaging in politicized prosecutions here. That will, of course, make it very difficult for the authorities to run a successful election next year, an election that will be considered fair by all major actors and constituencies, again, particularly in Oromia. And if that is the case, the vote will not really be the landmark democratic moment that was hoped for.
Among those who appeared in court on Monday was Bekele Gerba, deputy chairman of the OFC, who has also been charged with inciting violence and terrorism. His son, Samuel Bekele, told VOA that after attending several pre-trial court sessions, he is convinced his father's case has been politicized.
We expect them to come up with something a bit believable, but they just pulled the old trick. They recycled the old trick and they accused them of terrorism, telecommunication fraud and other things, but it is aimed to eliminate the formidable political opponents of Abiy Ahmed. I don't think they're going to convict them if they follow the rule of law.
Prime Minister Abiy last week said that Ethiopia is fully committed to its democratic transition, which he began in March 2018. Writing in The Economist magazine, he reaffirmed the importance of a free press, a vibrant civil society, an independent judiciary, and an open political space. But he also stated that certain individuals and groups in Ethiopia are harvesting the seeds of inter-ethnic and inter-religious division and hatred. Jawar's lawyer, Kadia Bulo said Monday that both Jawar and Bekele were merely expressing their rights by giving a voice to millions belonging to the Oromo ethnic group.
What Jawar and others have been doing for the past 2 days, they were challenging by through the legal channels. Right? That means they were organizing their people so that their interests to be secured in legal and only legal ways.
Jawar and other defendants are scheduled to appear back in court on Thursday. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
COVID-19 will be on the top of the agenda at the United Nations General Assembly next week in New York. For more on the annual summit, VOA's Jason Patenkin spoke with VOA's correspondent Margaret Bashar.
So I think you have to realize it's going to be a very different General Assembly this year. Normally, we have at least 100 presidents and prime ministers and royalty coming to New York attending these meetings. And some people call it diplomatic speed dating because you have all these bilateral meetings among the leaders. And there's a lot of in-person, face-to-face contact. And that's what makes the UN General Assembly week so important. But this year, of course, due to the coronavirus pandemic, it's going to be essentially a virtual meeting of world leaders. And so this has presented challenges, but it's also presented opportunities. One of the opportunities is that it's easier for people to participate, and they have actually a record participation for this year. There's about 120 heads of state attending virtually and 54 heads of government. And normally you'd get maybe 70 or 80 heads of state coming and maybe 30 heads of government. So it's a much bigger, higher level representation. They will give pre-recorded statements that will be played in the General Assembly. And it's that big iconic hall with the dome. This year, it will not be full of people because of COVID-19. Only one representative will be allowed from each country, which basically is their ambassador at the United Nations. Definitely COVID will be the topic, but we're also going to hear about rebuilding sustainably, coming back from this pandemic in a better place. It's shown in inequalities throughout the world, inequalities in healthcare and in jobs and things like that. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about how the world comes back from this stronger and more sustainable. And that also includes action on climate change, because that has really been a flagship issue for the UN. And it would have probably been the top issue at this General Assembly if it hadn't been for COVID. But it really is a part of the pandemic. So it will become a part of the recovery from it.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linar Mudu. The World Health Organization and the Africa Centers for Disease Control say there are no drugs approved to fight COVID-19. If you have tested positive, talk to a doctor before taking any medicines. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Lomeri by Suka Sukari.
Yeah, Suka Sukari in another style. Tupakana bangarieta. Palomera nasuro koto. Anangalangalangalangala. Yeah.
Tika kolong iba in kodong utulogolong bak male wati koruban kodong utulogolong bak kue shanto metadi do diong medene nu da yele koki mang ako buko nu medeni hey tomoro di do bak be domiji dole pelege lugura rata ini beti dolong utulogolong goti aligi so kobe tinti tolo merani dea do metani bengolong bak kuli. Lokodo bido simuti do apine marate pure adingona doro lumigur simune amoka ngomalo ngomane ken
na tolo meran
kilo komi diji kasera kire kina dolo e maine di do tu tetenda godo je tuan na tu korono tu kani kisulo to koni kono tuara chika kolu kiba in kodo mutu logo lomba male wati kolu ban kodo mutu logo lomba kue.
We've been listening to Suka Sukari with the song Lumeri. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Tommy Taddy, don't you make a little bit of a girl? Okay, man, I'll go.